15 years ago, Washingtonian and parenting expert Rosalind Wiseman published her book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boyfriends, and Other Realities of Adolescence. In 2004, it was famously adapted into the movie Mean Girls, written by Tina Fey. Here's a taste.
Gina, you're wearing sweatpants. It's Monday.
So? So that's against the rules, and you can't sit with us.
Whatever. Those rules aren't real.
They were real that day I wore a vest, because that vest was disgusting.
You can't sit with us!
The movie was an instant hit, and just last month, Mean Girls the Musical made its world debut at DC's National Theater. It runs until December 3rd. The story was such a success, in part, because the trials and tribulations of its high school heroine, Katie Heron, hit so close to home. In fact, they were partly based off real interactions that Wiseman observed from teenage girls in the DC area. Has teenage girlhood gotten any easier? Joining us now is Queen Bees and Wannabes author Rosalind Wiseman. Glad to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
And one of her former students, Washington Post columnist Alexandra Petri. Alexandra, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Alexandra is also the author of The Field Guide to Awkward Silences. Rosalind, you write in Queen Bees and Wannabes that understanding girl world is like putting on a new pair of glasses. What does that world look like, and why do you encourage parents and mentors to recognize it instead of dismissing it as teen drama?
Because when we dismiss it, then our young people won't talk to us, and they've got really complex issues, and those issues need to be respected. And if we want young people to talk to us and we want them to develop values that they can actually concrete apply in this increasingly complex world, then they need to be able to speak to us about what their world is like.
Rosalind, you were raised in Washington. You moved away after fifth grade, then you moved back a year later. How would you characterize your own experiences with girl world? How did they impact how you viewed yourself and your later research?
Well, I am a proud alum of John Eaton Elementary School at the street, and then I went to Murray and graduated from Murray. And then I had the privilege and honor of working with schools and organizations all around this area, including NCS, where Alex went to school and where she was one of the most brilliant. I'm not just saying this. She truly was one of the most brilliant students I've ever, ever had. Would ask questions that would completely floor me, like every time she opened her mouth.
I have no recollection.
I totally remember.
And you also did Dunbar, where my sons went to school.
I also taught at Dunbar. Yeah. No, I went to Dunbar. I remember I taught in the driving ed class where you couldn't move the desks. I remember that. But really, my experiences are pretty normal, problematic, but normal. And that doesn't make it right. And what was really amazing to me when I was doing the work I was doing as a young person in her early 20s was that really we needed to talk to girls about what their world and their lives were like so that we could give them the skills to be able to speak their truth and to be able to recognize their responsibilities to other people as well. It wasn't just about their rights. It was also about their responsibilities to other people, to treat other people with dignity.
Well, what's different now? How do the trials girls face today reflect what you experienced in your earlier years? And what are some of their most pressing issues today?
Well, certainly social media is difficult, but I also think that the hypocrisy and double standards that adults hold young people to is increasingly in their face on a constant basis, but adults don't like to talk about it. We don't like to talk about the messiness of our lives. I think we have a hard time having conversations with young people that admit the failures of adults and that we're not all failures and we're all not hypocritical or bad role models, but a lot of us are. And we need to be able to acknowledge that so that we can have true and honest conversations because our young people don't take us seriously. And I think they desperately want to, and they desperately want to get our guidance and advice. And at the same time, between parents' anxiety and blowing things out of proportion and thinking everything is bullying and when it's not, and micromanaging when they really should not be, and sometimes even then on the other extreme of just not getting involved when they really should, that it's really like confusing for young people. And then so of course, they always did, but now they are increasingly looking to peers and to what they see on social media as what they should be, what is normal. So for me, the work of getting adults to take a break, laugh at themselves a little bit, admit that they make mistakes, admit we're messy, and not micromanage and then not completely abdicate our responsibility, we could get to some common sense behavior.
Alexandra, you grew up in Georgetown. You were a student at the All-Girls National Cathedral School. What characterized girl world when you were young?
It's funny. This is all sort of coming back to me because both the just saw the Mean Girls musical for a second time, so you can tell I'm both bought into the mythos of it and remember it. But I think I was fortunate enough that I had sort of a very bro-y gaggle of gals where we were such gigantic nerds we didn't notice that we were being socially ostracized, which was very helpful for, like, my future development. And, like, we were the people where you would come into the building and there'd be a giant poster of a sexy elf from Lord of the Rings, and we'd sort of claimed that space. I think the school later removed it because they didn't want the first thing you saw on entering to be a sexy elf poster. But so we had sort of our space, and I think had I noticed, like, the few times when I noticed people being mean to me were very jarring. And I, like, in middle school, like, suddenly there was, like, this shift on the softball bus where, like, people weren't talking to me who had been talking to me. And, like, I spent a lot of time in the outfield wondering what I'd done wrong and failing to catch the balls as they came through. But I think, especially when you're in an all-girls environment, like, your female friendships really are sort of, like, everything to you. And as an only child, they were especially, like, these are the people who get to choose whether or not to spend time with me. My parents are contractually obligated. So it was it was fraught, I guess.
But, well, was all of that influenced by the fact that your school was single-sex?
I think to a certain extent, but I think some of it would happen no matter what environment you were in. My totally anecdotal experience of same-sex education is that for girls who wouldn't speak up in a co-ed environment, it's really good, and you don't have to worry, oh no, like, is Johnny Bowman staring at me? What will he think? And you can raise your hand and say that dorky thing you might not otherwise have said. And for girls who are just going to speak up anyway, they're going to speak up anyway. And so it's sort of a boon to people who might otherwise second-guess themselves. But I don't know if there's data to back that up, but that was my impression.
800-433-8850. Are you the parent of a daughter? What concerns do you have as she navigates social circles through different stages of her life? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Alexandra, when Rosalind came to your school, how was she and how were her methods of dealing with girls received?
Do you remember?
I do. I have a couple of distinct memories, which is, in Mean Girls, there's this scene where they all get into the gym together and they're talking about, like, what's the deal with, like, mean girls at our school? And Regina George raised her hand. She's like, can I be excluded from this because I don't feel that, like, I'm part of this whole mean thing. I'm not directly quoting it, which is a surprise given that the whole internet is just literally papered with Mean Girls quotations and I should have this by heart. But I do remember that exact thing happening.
She says, yeah, we don't have a click problem here.
And I remember the person who was responsible for clicks saying that exact thing during your session. So it was very like, oh, yes, maybe, what?
And that was the case, actually. What was so amazing about that is that whenever I was doing that at the time, Alex's class was not the only time that was happening. It was happening as a pattern. And so wherever I went, it was inevitably, that was not a surprise, where you would have the person with the most amount of power say, oh, no, we don't have that problem here.
Well, this is apparently the first time you two have seen each other since Alex was in sixth grade.
I know.
And the fact that you both clearly remember each other so well is just amazing to me.
I just have to say, I mean, really, truly, you do as a teacher have moments. And I'm not just saying this because she's sitting across from me. As a teacher, you have moments where there are some students who really stand out. And often for me, it's about the nature of the questions. And Alex asked excellent questions. And it's why I like working with teenagers anyway, because they usually do ask really good questions. But you were 11 or 12 years old, and she was asking excellent questions, and that's what I remember.
How was her poetry? Remember her poetry?
Yes, because I put it in the book. I did. Yeah. I put a book in the first edition. It was gorgeous. It was beautiful, and I put it into the first edition. It was so wonderful.
It was an ode to beauty.
It was.
That John Keats would probably have not been so proud
of. No, he would not have been. I think my favorite part was all during college, because it went from, like, oh no, Mean Girls, what's this thing, to being this, like, badge of honor that we were in somehow tangentially affiliated. And I'd be like, guys, did you know my poem is in the book on which Mean Girls is based? But then they would get out and read the poem, and it would say things like, beauty is a well-run sewage system in the eyes of a sewage worker. And they'd be like, who are you? Why are you writing this?
But that's awesome.
I thought it was.
Yeah, it's in the mind of the beholder, man.
Let's listen to another scene from Mean Girls, the movie.
Everybody close your eyes. Right. I want you to raise your hand if you have ever had a girl say something bad about you behind your back. Open your eyes. Now, close your eyes again. And this time, I want you to raise your hand if you have ever said anything about a friend behind her back. Open them. It's been some girl-on-girl crime here.
I'll start with you, Ross. In your experience, does it help to address issues of cliques and gossip head-on, the way Rosalind or Tina Fey's character tried to in the movie? What specific techniques have worked in the past for you, either in the teen girl world or adult girl world?
Well, I think it's really tricky because you can't walk in thinking and assuming that girls are always going to be horrible. One of the things I hate, I don't know what, Alex, what you think about this, but one of the things that's come out from, I think, from the popularity of Mean Girls and just this talking about all this, you know, quite a bit, is that we say, you know, girls are so hard and they're so difficult and boys are easy. And because they fight, boys fight and it's over, and girls like never let go of a grudge and that kind of stuff. It's gotten to the point where someone's pregnant and then you say, like, what are you having? They say a girl and you're like, oh gosh, Mean Girls. I have to say, you know, it's so unfair to both boys and girls because girls should not be given the expectation that they cannot depend on their female friendships and that it is their legacy that they will have these horrible friendships that will betray them. Girls have to have and need to have, and why I always do this work, is to have friendships that they can really depend on, but we have to acknowledge the conflicts that they get into and why they get into them. And for boys, it's totally unfair to boys because they have some kind of a complex, complicated, deep emotion reaction to something. When somebody breaks their heart or betrays them, there's something wrong with them if they don't just shrug it off. So I think it's an art form because I think it's really easy to simplify it and to assume that girls are really awful. And you walk in with that assumption, then the girls aren't speaking for themselves. And so what's really important is also not just to be able to talk about the bad things that somebody does to you, but like what I consistently do, which is to look for ways to take ownership of people, of their own behavior. And so that's when I think you get some honesty. But you also have to recognize in a classroom dynamic that sometimes there's how you have to be really creative about the way you do it, because kids who are smart, like socially intelligent and socially powerful, are always going to be trying to figure out ways to shut the conversation down.
Alex, the niche you carved out for yourself, it seems, going back to middle school and high school, seems to have served you well in the long term. You still maintain very close friendships with the people you were friends with back then.
That's true.
How come?
Well, I think going through high school is like serving in a unit with people in like a space war. and so, like, these are the people who went through that time period where it felt like a vast period of time. I know 4 years is always 4 years, but those particular 4 years and the time stretching back from that is an immense period of time when you sort of decide who you are and or try on a first couple of versions of who you are. And I think part of the reason the friendships continue is the longevity of those friendships. If I met these people now, I don't know that like we would instantly hit it off, but the fact that we remember who we used to be and can continue to sort of watch each other grow and like cheer each other on and like see the different paths that everyone's been taking has been really delightful. And like, I know my friend just had a kid, it's been like a year, speaking of years taking a short amount of time, but I think it's really interesting what you're saying about the whole sort of, you give birth to a girl and something's like Mean Girls, all these like people start sort of throwing pink stuff at you, or in my case, giving you a bunch of NASA stuff. But in the same way where it's like, we gotta somehow respond to this as though it's this like special different thing. And like, we have this idea that like all women are Cersei Lannister or sitting there at the in the midst of this Machiavellian web of schemes. And I think when you have to exercise power in that way, it's because maybe you haven't been given direct power or the expectation that you're going to be able to sort of go out in and assert yourself. And instead you have to say, well, what if I like manipulate the king by using poisons? And instead of just being able to state yourself and your preferences openly, you have to sort of wangle your way around in a, I think, unhealthy way for girls and also an unhealthy way for boys. And so it's like the whole witchcraft thing. Witchcraft is when someone has invisible power instead of like visible power. And mm-hmm. you can just say, oh, they made me do this thing. No, they didn't. You did the thing. But
right. I think when women don't have the power, when they don't have the power in it, or they're given the right to have it, then they feel that they have to exercise it in surreptitious ways. But also the other thing that happens is that even when some women who come into positions of power openly, that we have to be able to guide those women and to support those women to be able to exercise power in direct and forthright ways. And that's, by the way, I think one of the best things about all-girls schools is that it really allows that kind of thing. It encourages that kind of leadership.
Needless to say, a lot of people want to join this conversation. Let's start with Valerie in Maryland. Valerie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. I was saying that I wanted to address the issue, you know, we say middle school and college and high school, but I have a second grader who I'm already seeing that cliquish issues with them, and they have a girls' club, and how quickly the girls can be in the club and how quickly they can come out of the club, and they have rules. So in our school, we're trying to figure out how to address that issue now before they even get to middle school, because it only gets worse as they go along.
Yeah, with my sister, it was the Secret Seven. She was a member called the Secret Seven. Nobody else was allowed.
Well, it's not a surprise that at that age, because that's actually when we first see that kind of social dynamics happening with girls. But this is where I think it takes that really insightful adult who has credibility with the girls, so that, again, they're not pathologized as these mean girls. Because what happens when you do that is that sometimes girls will say, or it's very similar to when I actually was working with a school last week where a principal made the mistake of saying to the school, to a seventh grade, "You are the worst seventh grade I've ever seen." Well, seventh graders are going to look at that and go, "Sweet, we are the worst seventh graders you've ever seen. We're proud of that." And so we got to be careful about how we are delivering the message. And similarly here with a group of 7-year-olds. So when you're in that situation, an adult has to say, it's not saying to the girls, "This is what I expect of you." It's, I want to know from you all, what do you expect of yourselves? And you, so that together the group comes up with internalized guides and rules, so that when you get out of things like, who gets to make up the rules? Well, why? Have you ever had rules that you think are, any kid can relate to this, have you ever had a rule that anybody has ever said to you that doesn't make sense to you or you think is unfair? Most kids are going to say yes. Well, does that apply in this situation? Why does somebody get to make the rules? What's the why? And what do we do if we don't like that rule? Those are the kinds of conversations that we have to have.
We got an email from Kate who writes, "This is a cultural problem. Mothers need to talk to their daughters about how to be supportive of one another rather than competitive. Mothers need to check how they talk about other women. Don't watch Housewives of reality TV.
Oh, I could not agree with you more.
Girls,
awesome.
Girls will do what you do, not what you say. Alex, not only are you a columnist and author, but you're also a playwright. A recent show of yours, To Tell My Story, which debuted at the Silver Spring Black Box Theater, pays homage to Hamlet and takes place in high school. Why did you decide to tell the story of Hamlet through two teenage girls? And how did the contradictions of girl world play a part of that story?
Well, to me, what was really fascinating about it was, I think, I love Hamlet because it's a story that we as a culture take very seriously, where we're like, oh man, this guy has to decide whether he wants to do a revenge tragedy or not. But there are elements of that story that are very, I hate to say silly, but silly, where who, when given the opportunity, a ghost, a literal ghost, shows up to this guy and says, "Hey, looks like I've been murdered. Looks like your uncle did it. What do you want to do about this?" And Hamlet's response is, "You know, I'm going to hire some actors. I'm going to get some actors in from out of town. I'm going to write a show about it. They're going to put on the show." And then I'll sort of study the audience response. And who on earth is like, "Oh, murder. I got to put on some theater." So to me, that was sort of a very funny response to have. And that became the germ of the play, because I think high school girls and their emotions, except in works like yours and the Mean Girls, don't tend to be given this very serious treatment where, like, they're deeply felt and they're cathedral-sized, but you don't see them getting taken seriously. They're sort of dismissed and sort of shelved in a different area. And so to take Hamlet and drop it into that world and say, you know who else likes to dramatize their feelings and sort of make a play about what's going on in their lives? Teenage fanfic writers, and run with that, was to me both fun and an opportunity to tease out that comedy, but also an opportunity to take something seriously that I didn't see getting taken seriously.
The description line for To Tell My Story says, "To Tell My Story takes the story of Hamlet into the one place even more dark and dangerous than medieval Denmark, the mind of a teenage girl." Ross Alexander's play To Tell My Story is very of the moment. Much of the action takes place on the internet, and you mentioned this before, but when it comes to your work, how do you keep up with the changing dynamics of adolescence with the proliferation of social media? It's a totally different world than when you first started writing, when kids were just beginning to get cell phones.
Yeah, Alex, I think when you were in sixth grade, was like AOL, like what it was, AIM or something, was like the only thing we were talking about in the class. That's what I think I remember. So
right to me.
Right.
We're dating ourselves
right,
here.
Exactly. So what I do is what I've always did, which is I ask the girls, girls. I asked the boys. You know, I work with boys and always have, by the way, an equal amount as I have to girls. I would never, ever dare teach or speak about something that I had not asked the actual experts on to tell me what their lives are like. And so I spend a tremendous amount of time listening to young people and tell me what their lives are like on social media and what, and also, more importantly, what they're hearing from adults. And I think what's really important about that is for in social media is that what young people hear from adults is if you send an inappropriate picture, your life is over. You won't ever get a job. You won't ever get into college. Your life is over. And, you know, differently than I think a lot of young people, we think that young people feel invincible, and that can be really dismissive of their experiences, because we have a lot of young people that are really anxious and feel that they can't make any mistakes or else their life is over. So we compound that by saying, don't ever do something like that. And, you know, sometimes, and mistakes are mistakes, and we've all made mistakes on social media. So I think what we have to do is we listen to young people and we say, how are we coming across to you and what do you need? And when we do that, then they really open up. Even adolescent boys open up. And people have always said to me, like, how do you get boys to talk to you? And I'm like, I can't get boys to stop talking to me. Because people don't ask them. People lecture boys about what they're supposed to be doing. And then they also pathologize them in some ways or think they're lazy or think that they don't care or anything like that. And so my experience is that when you ask boys about their lives, just like girls, they will, when they trust you, they will, and they really believe that you're going to listen to them, they will start talking. So that's what I do.
Here's Lynn in Silver Spring, Maryland. Lynn, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, everybody. I'm a mom in the area, but also an occupational therapist, and I run a 12-week training program for girls' assertiveness, and it started I use Roslyn's book, and I'm just so happy to be able to say thank you personally, because the experiences that I've had with the girls are so profound just because they're able to put words to their experiences in their social world. So being able to talk about the clicks that happen and the roles that they have in it and how they can be passive, assertive, or aggressive, and they come back after each session we have, they come back and they just want to talk for hours about the experiences they've had, and they take responsibility for their own aggression and their own cliquishness and their own bullying, and it's amazing, and it kind of speaks to the question Kojo had about dealing with this head on, because it's, at least we do in our group, we deal with it head on, and they respond unbelievably so. I just want to thank you. Also, Rachel Simmons, I used her book too, and that's been great too. So you're both just
thank you. And Ray, I'll say thank you for Rachel on her behalf, because she's a really good friend.
Lynn, thank you very much for your call. We move on to Lauren in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Lauren, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Ross. Hi, Alex. It's Lauren from Defend Yourself. I had a couple things that I wanted to add, and I did not start at the beginning, so if they've been said, I apologize. I think there's a couple of more external factors that are really important here. One is that we as adults kind of create the expectations of this kind of behavior. So, you know, the thing, Ross, that you were saying about, you know, when a girl is born, people are like, oh, God, you know, and the way that mothers in particular talk to their daughters about friendship, and the things that girls see on television and in movies about how women and girls relate to each other kind of perpetuates it. And the other thing that I want to bring up, which you also touched briefly on, is that because women are oppressed and have a scarcity of power ourselves, I think that is a lot of the reason that there is so much horizontal.
Are those, in fact, external dynamics, Ross?
Oh, absolutely, for sure. And I think that those are complicated, and we have to be what's so difficult for us. And Alex actually writes about so well that I've read in some of her columns, is that these things are nuanced. And when we want to be able to hold people accountable for their actions, we have to be able to understand the nuance of the of the actions of people who and how we got there. And I think that that's absolutely, as Lauren says, that's absolutely one of the dynamics that not only is there, but that we are very, we just struggle with and will continue to do so.
Alex, in your column, you often comment on the goings-on of national politics. Do you see parallels between the cutthroat years of Girl World and the cutthroat careers of official Washington?
Well, I don't know who's being flattered by this comparison.
Good point.
This is a, I guess, somewhat horizontal answer to your question, but one of the things that strikes me increasingly about Mean Girls, the more we're sort of like living in the world and decades pass, is it's a show that's about all female characters that you scarcely notice it's all about. Because usually, like, you have to wait decades and then Wonder Woman comes in and it's a movie with a woman in it and everyone's very excited. And Mean Girls was just all women. And getting to see sort of the variety of female experience, even this, like, in this narrow area, which is sort of like a heightened caricature of how people interact, still, like, created all of these iconic, and just seeing that multiplicity of female experience, even in the news these days, when I look at who's in the White House and I look at who's wandering around wielding power, and just seeing the absence of that, it's, you know, that's one area where I wish it were more like Mean Girls.
Well, I know that Alex has seen it maybe twice, but have you, Ross, seen the Mean Girls
the musical? I'm going on Friday with my family because my boys are here. And then I'm going to meet the cast afterwards, and we're going to be doing a really wonderful, positive campaign around the time that it debuts and comes out in New York. So we are starting the process of doing a wonderful thing for girls, because as wonderful as the movie and the play, you know, the musical is, it's really not wonderful for some boys and girls and children, however they identify themselves, for young people around the country. And so we want to be able to do something that really elevates it and does something positive for everyone, people who come to see the musical, but also people, you know, just a way to be able to focus on positive behavior and what we can do to make things better.
We got a Twitter message from Rebecca who said, I read the book Queen Bees and Wannabes when I was 13, and it changed my whole life. It was like the whole world opened up for me at middle school. It helped me navigate relationships, and I still read it once a year and apply it. And apply it to adult life.
Wow.
So yeah.
I'm hoping that you have read the third edition, because I actually I had to redo it because the you know, world changed a little bit, but with social media and stuff like that. And also, by the way, girls would criticize me and make it, and say I needed to critique me and say I needed to do it better. So I actually did subsequent editions to make that reflective of where girls are today.
Rosalind Wiseman is the author of Queen Bees and Wannabes. Alexandra Petri is a columnist for The Washington Post. She's the author of The Field Guide to Awkward Silences. Thank you both for joining.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. I'm Kojo Nambi.
The Kojo Nambi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, and Avery Kleiman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nambi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.